Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. Peter Frizzell is an end-of-life care social worker. He recently received his MFA from Manhattanville College. An accomplished author, he has published several poems and short stories, and now two critically acclaimed books, An Angelic Folly and The Fermented Savior. In An Angelic Folly, you'll find the story of Jacob Monger, a social worker at a hospice who has just been through a painful divorce and is having his two young daughters overnight for the first time. Jacob also attends to Tony, a hospice patient and Vietnam veteran who has a penchant for collecting records and playing Mozart's The Requiem. Tony is dying and trying to settle unfinished business with his own children. Helping Tony is made more difficult by the Archangel Gabriel, who is also having his own qualms with his father. Matters of life, death, and hereafter all are on Jacob's mind in this moving drama. In The Fermented Savior, you'll meet Marie Martin, a young girl who is the daughter of two vineyard workers at Baron Rothschild's estate, which once housed Marie Curie's lab, causing the soil to become radioactive and magical. After the Baron leaves for Great Britain due to his Jewish origins, Marie's family is left to run the estate occupied by the Germans. While the Baron is gone, she discovers that grapes, they're magical, and that once when the white vineyard are pro-Nazi, those in the purple vineyard are Jewish. The purple grapes reveal that if made into wine, they can convince those who drink them that the Jews should not be persecuted. Gunter Adler is the son of a viticulturist who worked with the Baron as his business partner in Germany before the war. He finds himself helping Marie harvest the Jewish grapes to help the Jewish populace while simultaneously being under pressure to supply wine for the German Air Force. Marie and Gunter do their best to stay one step ahead of the Nazis and do their best to help the resistance save France's Jewish population. Author Peter Frizzell, author of An Angelic Folly and The Fermented Savior, joins us now on This Week in America. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us on the program to talk about these two fine books receiving rave reviews. We'll give you all the information on Peter's books, availability, of course, Amazon, the usual places, as we go through our conversation today. First of all, let's start about with An Angelic Folly. What was the inspiration for writing this book?
I went through a very, very painful divorce. Divorce is never pleasant to begin with, but I think some are more painful than others. This happened at the end of social work school when I was graduating, and, you know, it really opened my eyes to many things. In social work school, you're always taught to meet the client where they're at and not to judge. Now it's human to judge, and initially I did judge some of my clients. I was interning at a hospice, and many would open up to me, such as being unfaithful or being, you know, phantom fathers or doing things that probably many of us would not do. However, you know, my judgment got curtailed when I realized that I had to face something very painful. And, you know, this facing of something painful was in a way angelic because it let me be a better social worker. And the folly, the other part of the title, was, you know, my short-sightedness before my eyes were open. I also, just as importantly, if not more so, wanted to write about my struggle with parenthood, especially as a single parent temporarily, as good parents try to be angels to their kids. But that's never the reality. We all make mistakes, but we keep trying to be angels.
Well, you face all of those in your book, An Angelic Folly. The author, our guest, Peter Frizzell, that's P-R-I-Z-E-L. Again, you'll find the book at Amazon, usual places. A link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Why did you lean so heavily on Mozart's Requiem for your story? And what does it symbolize for you in this book?
Well, the Requiem, you know, any Requiem to begin with is a death mass, you know, basically. And this takes place in a hospice. A Requiem is divided usually into 12 sections. And many of my hospice patients, you know, there's Kubler-Ross's four stages, you know, denial, bargaining, you know, and then acceptance, you know, of death. So that, you know, dovetails nicely with the hospice patients. It also, when Mozart actually wrote this, he was actually actively dying. And the way the commission came about is that there was an amateur musician who commissioned him to do it but did not want them to know who really wrote it. And Mozart actually died while writing this. And anyone who commissioned, you know, a piece for Mozart and passed it off as their own, you know, must have been very insecure to begin with, I would think. And, you know, death brings insecurity to all of us, or most of us. It's the great unknown. No one's ever, quote-unquote, lived to tell the tale, really. And many, in my experience of being an intern in a hospice, many of our insecurities come out during death, and we try to take care of our unfinished business. And as you know, you asked me my first question, you know, many of my hospice patients who I depict here did air their quote-unquote dirty laundry and were very insecure with it about me and those that they tried to make amends with. Finally, you know, the Requiem represents, because it's death, the disintegration of my marriage in different movements. So I thought the symbolism was very poignant.
It's a very thoughtful and insightful book, An Angelic Folly by Peter Prizel, P-R-I-Z-E-L, our guest on the program today. So well done. I love the symbolism. We'll talk in a bit about the writing process and putting all of this together. It is so well written, the book, An Angelic Folly. What gave you the idea for Ezekiel's chariot and the use of its wheels? And why did you select the Archangel Gabriel when you could have chosen Raphael or Michael, for instance?
Well, you know, Gabriel in the Old and New Testament is the messenger angel. And often people in hospice, you know, get messages about, you know, mortality and everything. You know, unlike Raphael, who's a healer and, you know, not a guardian angel like Michael. You know, to me, messages, you know, can be presented in different ways and bent to suit our own agendas, which is sometimes what happens when people are defensive and, you know, taking stock of their life. You know, in Jewish commentary, Ezekiel's chariot is the vehicle that holds God himself. So I found that to be very powerful imagery. And, you know, I like to dovetail that with Christianity. Most of my clients were Jewish and Catholic at this hospice. I didn't have many of the Eastern religions, because the wheels represent the four Gospels. And the creatures in them all have different personalities. I really like that, and that's why I did it. It was a really, I think, very metaphysical but visual vehicle.
And very powerful as well. As I say, as you read this, it really gets all of us thinking about life, death, spirituality, all of those elements that go into life and the end of life. Tell us about the characters in hospice and what you've seen as an end-of-life care social worker, how it's influenced this book, and how it's influenced you.
Well, what I noticed is often people's personalities morph in the end of life because they're more vulnerable and they become more vulnerable, and, you know, their shell of defensiveness sometimes, you know, crumbles away. Actually, sometimes their personalities, I find, morph, so, in my opinion, morph so much that it's hard to really discern who they were before they got into hospice and who they are now. Of course, some people are open about their past than others, but I think that people are more, honest about their flaws. And, you know, it's human nature to make mistakes. And, you know, I have children. I have a five-year-old now who, you know, we'll say, you know, Dad, go look over there. I'm not going to go do anything, then she'll disappear. You know, kids, you know, tell, you know, white lies. But I found in hospice, you know, often people become their most vulnerable and share the most authentic version of themselves. And really in any good work, especially a work of fiction, you know, you want to have a lot of degree of believability of your characters. And the more authentic they are, the more they come through, and the better work of literature it is.
Well, you've done an excellent job with a work of literature and developing the characters in Angelic Folly, the book available again wherever books are sold. Peter Prizel, P-R-I-Z-E-L, is the author, and you'll find a direct link to his Amazon page at our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Peter, what messages are you trying to send the readers? What do you hope the takeaway is after someone reads An Angelic Folly?
Parenting is the hardest job in the world, but also the most rewarding. I'm not saying, you know, day jobs or working two or three jobs. I'm not making light of that. But parenting, you always, have to be on your feet. And, you know, as the title of my novel says, I mean, parenting comes with a lot of follies on the parent's side and a lot of angelic moments. And these are interspersed, you know, with deaths and sorrow felt by parents. Not literal deaths even, but, you know, children do grow up, And, you know, while they may drive you up the wall or through a wall when they're young, you know,
yes.
you start to, you know, miss those days, especially getting to be teenagers. And even when they're adults and they come back and love you again, you can't replicate the childhood. I mean, your kids are independent. Hopefully they have their own lives. But you'll miss it. And that, in a way, is also a death, which you mourn, even though you're proud that your kids grow up. So I'm just trying to, you know, emphasize how hard parenting is, but how worth it it is as well.
How has your job dealing with end of life and writing this book, how has it changed you, or has it changed you?
I think it's a work in progress in how it's changing me.
Yes.
I'm trying not to, quote unquote, sweat the small stuff. I mean, you know, when I work in end-of-life places, I mean, while I'm in them, realize that, you know, yes, I have problems. Who doesn't? But they're really quite minuscule compared to these people. And I hope that it's changing me to be a more compassionate person. And I'm hoping by not swaying the small stuff, quote-unquote, I can instill that in my children and make them, you know, be more compassionate people. So I really hope it's making me a better parent and social worker. I mean, those are, you know, the two main things in my life now. I have a job as a parent, and I have a vocation as a social worker.
It has made you an insightful author. The first book we're talking about in the program today is An Angelic Folly. Peter Prezeld, the author, is our guest on the program. The second new book out is The Fermented Savior. Gave you a brief synopsis of that at the beginning of the conversation. What inspired you to write The Fermented Savior?
I was actually, I had two majors in college, history and comparative religion. And, you know, I've been interested in many other faiths. Actually, my two best friends are two priests. I happen to be Jewish, two Catholic priests. So I'm very close to people. And, I once asked these my friends, the priests, is there anything we can do to hasten the second coming? And I was told by them, you know, no, it's on God's time. And I think that people, especially when they're under stress, such in times of war, where this work takes place in World War II, they lose faith naturally and lose all trust in God or their higher power. Often people become alienated and abandon God altogether. And, people, you know, like in the pandemic, you know, and other times, they even use alcohol to cope, with their sorrows.
Yes.
But I want to write a story that kind of somewhat turned, we see alcohol on its head. You know, I mean, I took the idea of a fermented savior. That's, you know, the symbol of the Eucharist in the Catholic faith. So that it's actually a good thing that that gives life. And grapes are very powerful in the Jewish religion. So it's made from grapes wine. So I was able to juxtapose those two ideas, you know, and also the Jewish philosophy that, you know, he who saves one life saves the world. And in this story, there are people who are saved. And so that comes through very clearly, I think, or at least I hope it does.
You lean so heavily on radioactivity for the magical grapes that we talked about. What was behind this choice?
Well, radioactivity, as we all know, is very dangerous. If you visit Marie Curie, where she's buried, actually, her coffin's encased in lead because it's so radioactive. And you would get, if it wasn't, you would get very sick. The other thing about radioactivity is, you know, there's the idea when a radioactive matter breaks down of half-lives. And I really like the concept of half-lives because, it shows the, if you compare it to the Nazis, it shows their inhumanity. I mean, even when the Nazis could hear the Soviet tanks, you know, a few miles away, they became even more brutal against their captives. And I also use the radioactivity because, you know, you think of glowing things and everything. And, you know, my grapes, they do talk. It's magical realism. And I liked the little scientific bend behind it because, you know, magical realism is, you know, quote unquote metaphysical. But, you know, radioactive activity is based on hard science, which is something you can actually prove. So I love the fantasy against the actual science you could prove. So that's why I really use the radioactivity motif.
You know, it's interesting when you think of white and purple, at least, by Western standards, we think of white normally as a pure color, purple as a royal one. possibly would have thought you would have had the purple grapes be the Nazis, the white pure ones, the Jews. Why did you do the opposite?
I'm not a connoisseur of wine, but, you know, when you get a really good red wine, it's really dark. I mean, it's almost like blood. And a lot of innocent blood of Jews and others was shed in the wars, which is why I made those grapes purple. And, you know, if you look at really, really white grapes, I mean, they're almost transparent. And, while initially you could argue Hitler tried, to hide some things from people, I mean, he and the Nazis were extremely transparent on their agenda and what they did, and their actions show that. And, there's really no way to masquerade around it. So I like the red for the unfortunate sacrifice. I mean, the word Holocaust, which I'm hesitant to use, but in Greek actually does mean burnt offering, which is de facto a sacrifice. And, the white grapes, as I said, are translucent and transparent, and Nazi crimes really were and still are.
The book by Peter Purcell is The Fermented Savior. Again, you'll find that wherever books are sold, the Amazon link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Put you on the spot here. Do you have a favorite scene in this book, The Fermented Savior? And if so, why is it a favorite scene?
Well, put me on the spot. Thank you. That's a good one. Let me see. I would have to say it's at the end. Secondary characters are Baron Rothschild and Adler, who were two partners, one from France, one from Germany, in the wine business. And, I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but I'll do a miniature one. It just so happens that Rothschild inadvertently kills Adler's son, and Adler returns from the Eastern Front, and he's not aware his son is dead, but Rothschild's aware. And it's very hard for Rothschild to tell his best friend and his business partner what happened to his son, and that's at the very ending. And it shows, in spite of, best intentions, as the cliche goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
You touch on a number of themes in The Fermented Savior. What are you trying to send to the reader? Again, what is the takeaway? What do you hope is the message that resonates with them after they finish your book?
Life is full of ups and downs. The movies often, sugarcoat it, and it's hard. But try to get through it and, do the best you can as a person. And it's easier said than done. And often, sometimes things you don't know are good or hard lessons, they have to age and ferment to, quote unquote, ferment until you're mature enough, hopefully, to understand them and have them work with you. That's what I was trying to insinuate in this work.
Well, mission accomplished. And we got a few minutes left here at the end. I'd like to talk about the writing process, coming up with the themes for the book and then implementing them in an enlightening and entertainment and entertaining format, as you do in your books. How difficult? Let's start with the first book, An Angelic Folly. How long did it take you to write that? And did you start from a complete outline before you began writing the book?
An Angelic Folly took 12 years. Really, from start to finish. It morphed in so many ways. The first draft actually took place with the disintegration of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and World War One with Franz Josef and everything, because he was actually a very good father, believe it or not. So it really, really morphed from time period and everything. I realized if I kept it there, the message wouldn't be as clear and authentic, and, you try not to, as a writer, spoon-feed the reader, quote-unquote, and, I realize unless you're a history major, there would have been too much spoon-feeding. So, yeah, this was really 12 years, and I also needed time, because I started writing it actually during my divorce, and I realized I needed time to get a fresher perspective. So that took 12 years.
How about The Fermented Savior? How long on that?
That took me about 6 weeks.
Oh,
okay. It's really ironic.
You cut a decade out of the writing process and then some.
Yeah, I usually do some research with history books before writing it, but the actual process, I did have an editor. My grammar's not the best, and I do have typos, I confess, but, I wrote the first draft in about 4 weeks, and then I had 2 weeks off from work, took vacation, and did it there. I do think that what helped me also is that it was not as close to me personally, so it was easier to write.
Yes.
And also, you know, I think it was more action-based and somewhat less philosophical, which, you know, made it easier for me to write the content. Yeah, that would be it. I mean, I wouldn't say write a book in 6 weeks usually, but it seemed to be right for this time.
Well, I think the lesson there is if it's coming, don't stop. Don't stop the flow. Let it come and tell the story. I love the creativity that you put into both of these books. You've been very successful writing poems and short stories. What was it like doing these two books after the success of poems and short stories?
Ironically, you know, I always did this type of writing first, you know, when I was younger. But in my MFA program, you know, they said, Peter, you have so much creativity, you should try to write short stories and poems because those you have to focus, you know, more on because you have too many ideas. So I did that for, you know, most of grad school. I wrote shorter pieces, but that helped me prepare to write these longer pieces.
What are you working?
I didn't like the time.
Yeah, what are you working on now? Any books in that you can talk about?
Yeah, I'm working on two things right now, and having a few things published next year. What I'm working on now is a novel about the Chagall windows of the 12 tribes of Israel in Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, and of how you know, each of those windows represents you know, conflict in families and everything, and you know, family dynamics, and you know, Israel and the Palestinian territories are, you know, unfortunately a land of much ethnic strife, even though there's probably a lot more in common than the people who live there realize. So I tried to depict it through art, and I try to have at least a fairly amicable resolution. So that novel will hopefully be done in about a month, and then hopefully some agent will take it. I'm also working on a play, a full-length play about Tchaikovsky and King Louis II of Bavaria, you know, who both, you know, were homosexual in an era where that, you know, was not okay, and actually both probably at least Tchaikovsky committed suicide, but Lubick did not. It's a fictional romance about them, set against the backdrop of Tchaikovsky's ballet Swan Lake, which actually the swan was also the symbol of Lubick's Bavaria. So that I just started, and you know, the two things coming out, I have a poetry chapbook called Rodin's Hands after the great sculptor, a series of chapbooks about his hands coming out next summer, and I have a collection of short stories coming out at the University of Alabama Press, but the title's to be determined.
You've got a lot coming up, and the two new books, I hope we get a chance to talk about. You reading your books, you make us think, you make us feel. Again, I love the creativity and tying all of these themes together in a very entertaining way. The books are a delight to read. The Four-Minute Savior, along with An Angelic Folly. Our guest on the program is Peter Prizel, P-R-I-Z-E-L, if you're Googling, book available. Wherever books are sold, the link, of course, on our website. And my thanks to Levitt Peak Press as well, not just a publishing company, but a dedicated partner in your literary success. I thank them for arranging our conversation with Peter. Peter, a pleasure having you on the program. Hopefully we can do this again. Excellent job on your two books. Thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you so much for taking the time to allow me to express myself freely. And thank you to all the listeners out there. And I hope you have a peaceful day. Thank you.
And you as well. A pleasure having you on the program. Peter Prizel, P-R-I-Z-E-L, the books An Angelic Folly and The Fermented Savior. Of course, information on our website, thisweekinamerica.us, direct link to Peter's Amazon page. You can order the books there as well. You're listening to This Week in America, and we're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.